Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 5th of July, these are our main stories. Britain has a new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, after a landslide victory in the UK general elections for the Labour Party.
Our country has voted decisively for change, for national renewal and a return of politics to public service.
Following the Conservative Party's worst ever defeat, Rishi Sunak apologises to the country.
I have heard your anger, your disappointment, and I take responsibility for this loss. I will step down as party leader, not immediately, but once the formal arrangements for selecting my successor are in place.
Also in this podcast, the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has met President Putin in Moscow, a trip which has angered other European leaders. And an heiress to the Disney fortune has announced she's withholding donations to the Democratic Party over President Biden's candidacy. We begin this podcast in the UK, where the Conservative government has suffered a crushing general election defeat after 14 years in power. With nearly all the results now in, as we record this podcast, Labour has won well over 400 seats, more than three times the number that the Conservatives have managed to cling on to. Their tally of just over 120 seats stands in stark contrast to the last election 5 years ago, when under Boris Johnson, their pledge to deliver Brexit won them the support of some voters who had traditionally backed Labour. But now, with many worried about Britain's stagnating economy, high taxes and struggling public services, those voters have abandoned the Conservatives, with many returning to Labour. After being formally appointed Prime Minister by King Charles, the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, addressed the nation outside Downing Street. He said he realised the scale of the challenge ahead.
For too long now, we've turned a blind eye as millions slid into greater insecurity. Nurses, builders, drivers, carers, people doing the right thing, working harder every day, recognised at moments like this before, yet as soon as the cameras stop rolling, their lives are ignored. I want to say very clearly to those people, not this time. Changing a country is not like flicking a switch. The world is now a more volatile place. This will take a while. But have no doubt that the work of change begins immediately. Have no doubt that we will rebuild Britain. You have given us a clear mandate, and we will use it to deliver change, to restore service and respect to politics, end the era of noisy performance, tread more lightly on your lives, and unite our country. Four nations standing together again, facing down, as we have so often in our past, the challenges of an insecure world, committed to a calm and patient rebuilding. So, with respect and humility, I invite you all to join this government of service in the mission of national renewal. Our work is urgent, and we begin it today. Thank you very much.
His predecessor, Rishi Sunak, did manage to hold on to his own seat, even though many high-profile members of the Conservative Party lost theirs, including the woman he replaced, Liz Truss. This is what Mr. Sunak had to say outside 10 Downing Street earlier. He began by addressing those who'd voted for his party.
I am sorry. I have given this job my all. But you have sent a clear signal that the government of the United Kingdom must change, and yours is the only judgment that matters. I have heard your anger, your disappointment, and I take responsibility for this loss. Following this result, I will step down as party leader, not immediately, but once the formal arrangements for selecting my successor are in place. It is important that after 14 years in government, the Conservative Party rebuilds, but also that it takes up its crucial role in opposition professionally and effectively. Whilst he has been my political opponent, Sir Keir Starmer will shortly become our Prime Minister. In this job, his successes will be all our successors, and I wish him and his family well. Whatever our disagreements in this campaign, he is a decent, public-spirited man who I respect. He and his family deserve the very best of our understanding as they make the huge transition to their new lives behind this door, and as he grapples with this most demanding of jobs in an increasingly unstable world. One of the most remarkable things about Britain is just how unremarkable it is that two generations after my grandparents came here with little, I could become Prime Minister, and that I could watch my two young daughters light Diwali candles on the steps in Downing Street. We must hold true to that idea of who we are, that vision of kindness, decency, and tolerance that has always been the British way. This is a difficult day, at the end of a number of difficult days. But I leave this job honoured to have been your Prime Minister. This is the best country in the world, and it is thanks entirely to you, the British people, the true source of all our achievements, our strengths, and our greatness. Thank you.
Our political correspondent, Rob Watson, has been following developments from Downing Street.
This was not so much a Labour victory as a Conservative loss, a collective two fingers up from the voters of Britain to the Conservatives after their 14 years in power. Because what you've really seen is Labour, yes, with an absolute thumping parliamentary majority, but actually with a relatively modest overall share of the votes cast. This is not 1997, this is not cool Britannia, this is not welcome Tony Blair, this is not a country whose economy is booming, welcoming in a younger Prime Minister. The times are different, and I think Sir Keir Starmer knows that.
And Keir Starmer has done a remarkable job in turning around the Labour Party after it suffered its worst election result in decades 5 years ago. The big question is, can he do the same for the country?
Well, it's a huge challenge because essentially this was a vote against the Conservative Party. It was also a vote against what many people in Britain would just describe as the sense that nothing here works anymore, that the public services, as you mentioned, were under strain, that taxes are high, and that they're looking for someone to fix that. But of course, that won't be easy. I mean, it wasn't easy for the Conservatives because you can't get away from the harsh economic reality, and that is that Britain has pretty high national debt, like a lot of other European countries. The economy isn't growing enough to provide the tax revenues to pay for the public services that an increasingly ageing and ailing population wants. So it's going to be a massive, massive challenge. And also, of course, against a backdrop of profound distrust and lack of confidence in politicians and the political system.
As you say, huge challenge and loss of confidence in politicians. But Keir Starmer is an unusual politician. He doesn't have the charisma of some of his predecessors like Tony Blair or Boris Johnson, but he does have a very solid record as a prosecutor, someone who entered politics very late. For a lot of our listeners, he'll be a bit of a mystery. Tell them about him.
Yes, well, what he's trying to make as his trump card, if you like, is that he's not a career politician, or hasn't been so far. He often says he's not a tribal politician, and he certainly doesn't have any of the touches of flair that people would perhaps associate with Boris Johnson. He only came to politics pretty late in life. He was in his 50s when he was elected an MP. He'd spent his life as a human rights lawyer and went on to have this big job as the country's chief prosecutor. So he's had a responsible job in public service, and that is his whole sales pitch to the people, which is, you know, I'm not flash, it's not going to be super exciting, but the very thing that I'm promising you, as we just heard, was a politics that treads more lightly on people's lives, a bit less drama, a bit less work for people like us to do.
And he knows that his honeymoon won't be long, and he is aware of the dangers of populism, because we've seen the vote in Britain is fragmenting more than it used to, which is, it's a system in Britain which is usually seen two big parties dominate.
You're right. I mean, you have a combination of a very low turnout this time, you have a diminishing vote share for the two big parties that used to command massive, massive support, and that does suggest a fragmentation. And I have seen the theory advanced here in Westminster that this is the sort of last chance for a government to be moderate and to resist Britain shifting to the populist right, as we've seen in other European countries. I mean, whether that exactly is true or not, it's hard to say. But I think it is the case that if this is a decisive result by Labour, there's no doubt about it. Will it be a return to stability? I think that depends on what Labour can crack the challenges that have faced governments all over Europe. Number one, to restore economic growth, to stop living standards stagnating. Two, to get public services working. And three, to settle the really difficult issues of, I guess, how we all get along, social cohesion in diverse societies, how you make multiculturalism work, how you address the issue of net migration in a way that satisfies all parts of the country. It won't be easy, but that is the challenge. If we're not going to see another dramatic change in political fortunes in another 5 years' time, Jeanette.
Rob Watson. It's not just the Conservatives who've suffered huge losses. After dominating Scottish politics for years, the pro-independent Scottish National Party has also experienced a wipeout. From winning 48 of Scotland's 59 seats in the elections 5 years ago, it is, as we record this podcast, now down to 9. The leader of the SNP in Westminster is Stephen Flynn. He was one of those who did manage to keep his seat.
We are going to be beat in Scotland, and we are going to be beat well. So now is the time where we must learn and we must listen. We must listen to what the people of Scotland have told us.
So what does this Labour win mean for the people of Scotland? Katie Hunter is our correspondent in Glasgow.
Labour have won seat after seat here in Scotland, but the biggest story of the night is the scale of the defeat for the Scottish National Party. This is a party used to winning elections in recent years and winning big. So it has been a really, really tough night for them. With just a few seats left to declare in Scotland, Labour are currently sitting on 37 seats, the SNP on just 9. And to give you some context, you mentioned that the last general election in 2019, the SNP won 48 seats in Scotland and Labour won just a single seat back then. So the turnaround overnight has been huge. And I'm in Glasgow overlooking the Clyde. And a few weeks ago, all of Glasgow's seats were in SNP hands. For people waking up this morning, this city, Scotland's biggest city, has turned red. Labour have won all 6 of Glasgow's seats from the SNP. And I think the story here in Scotland's biggest city has been replicated in constituencies across Scotland, particularly in the central belt of Scotland.
So why did the SNP fare so badly? And what does that mean for hopes of independence for Scotland?
Well, that's a big question on independence. And I think a question the SNP will spend the coming weeks and months asking themselves. First Minister and SNP leader John Swinney, he's only been in the job for around 8 weeks. It has been a tough year or so for the SNP. He has acknowledged that, and he said it had been a difficult and damaging night for the SNP, and a lot of soul searching would lie ahead. Now, the party did, in their manifesto, have the issue of independence on page one, line one of that manifesto. You know, John Swinney was talking about independence, but there are certainly some independent supporters that don't think the issue was front and centre enough during the campaign. In the days running up to this election, John Swinney was telling voters this election would be on a knife edge in Scotland, too close to call here. The result has proved far from too close to call. The SNP have lost in Scotland and they have lost big.
Katie Hunter. Leaders around the world have been congratulating the new British Prime Minister. The French President Emmanuel Macron said he looked forward to working with Keir Starmer. Ukraine's leader Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed Labour's win, saying Britain would remain a reliable ally under Mr. Starmer. But behind the warm words after the trauma of the Brexit years, can we expect any changes in the relationship between the UK and its European neighbours under a Labour government? I put that question to our correspondent in Berlin, Damian McGuinness.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the question that everyone here on the continent of Europe is asking, Jeanette. And I think one thing we can say is that Britain rejoining the EU anytime soon is off the cards. That has been stated quite clearly by Keir Starmer, who doesn't, it seems, want to reopen that quite ferocious debate that Britain had for many years about whether to be in or out the EU. And also, you know, it has to be said, there is a lack of trust on the EU side in Britain's ability to stay calm and non-chaotic. And I think what we've seen over the last few years is a real lack of interest of what happens in the UK because of perceived chaos and this constant churn of PMs going in and out of number 10. All that has now changed, and we're seeing that in press coverage across Europe, where people are suddenly looking to London again and thinking, ah, someone new back in number 10 and someone who maybe we can talk to. So what we've seen, as you say, President Macron has congratulated Keir Starmer, also lots of politicians from Olaf Scholz's centre-left party, and what we're seeing across the continent are certainly centre-left and centrist politicians thinking, OK, we've got someone in London we can now talk to. And I think that's what it's really about. It's not so much that anything concrete is going to change in the straight away in terms of the deals between London and Brussels, but certainly the tone, the relationship and the manner of how London talks to the rest of Europe is going to change. And I think there's a lot of relief here about that, because the debate or the relationships have been strained. And I think there's been a lack of trust here on the continent towards London. And I think now people feel that they have someone in Keir Starmer they can talk to who's seen as a non-populist and someone who's not going to sort of fight unnecessary battles with the EU. So I think it's going to be the start of rebuilding that relationship and a reset, if you like. I think that's how it's being seen here.
And another key issue for Europe is the war in Ukraine. And the UK has been a key player in regards to support for Kyiv.
Yeah, and of course, as you'll know, that support is cross-party in the UK. So it's not likely that much is going to change there. But certainly from the European perspective, there's a huge appetite for more cooperation with the UK, and certainly under a new, more pragmatic leader. And so one of the areas where the EU is very aware that it would be in their interest to work with the UK more closely is on defence and security. So I think what we're definitely going to see are more talks on defence and security, and that obviously involves Ukraine, but particularly in the run-up to elections in the US in the autumn, because I think there's a big awareness here that if Donald Trump is once again president, then there's going to be lots of questions about whether you can rely on the US and, you know, what does that mean for NATO? A lot of nervousness about that, particularly here in Germany. And that's where the UK comes in. So I think what we've already been seeing the past few months is lots of talks between Berlin and the Labour Party and shadow ministers. And so already people have been laying the groundwork, particularly on security and defence. And I think we're going to see possibly that's going to be one of the areas where there would be more change and possibly more cooperation.
Damian McGuinness. Still to come in this podcast, as Hurricane Beryl makes landfall in Mexico, we hear about the devastation it's caused on the island of Carriacou in Grenada.
Our airport, police station, all government buildings, infrastructure, homes are completely destroyed, people are homeless.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast. European leaders have reacted with anger and disbelief at the news that the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has gone to Russia. Rumours of the trip began to spread on Wednesday, and now a plane used by the Hungarian government has landed in Moscow. So why has this trip provoked such strong feelings? Our Europe regional editor Paul Moss explains.
They take it in turns to be in charge among the European Union's elected leaders, and Viktor Orban's only held the position of council president since Monday. But rather than slowly easing his way into the post, he's begun by taking just about the most provocative step he could as far as many fellow EU leaders are concerned. His visit to Moscow was described by the Finnish Prime Minister Petri Orpo as disturbing. Poland's Donald Tusk expressed disbelief at the news. That's because Viktor Orban is a close ally of Vladimir Putin and has repeatedly tried to block EU measures designed to help Ukraine. Earlier this week, Mr. Orban went to Kyiv and apparently tried to persuade Volodymyr Zelensky to accept a ceasefire, something many believe would suit Moscow, giving it more time to build up Russia's military strength. In an interview on Friday morning, Viktor Orban insisted that any visit to Moscow would be on a bilateral basis. But lest there be any doubt, the European Union's foreign policy chief was emphatic. Josep Borrell said in a statement that Viktor Orban had no right to negotiate on behalf of the European Union.
Paul Moss. Now to the Gaza conflict. Israel's spy chief is expected in Qatar today for the latest diplomatic efforts to try to reach a ceasefire, which will see the hostages being held by Hamas released. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell told us more.
What's really important is that the Israelis have sent, you know, the head of the Mossad intelligence service. This suggests a real seriousness on their part to resume these stalled talks. And we know that the head of Mossad is supposed to meet the Qatari prime minister later. We've had a sort of steer from a senior US official who has been talking to journalists anonymously, but really saying that there is some kind of a breakthrough in terms of the shift in the Hamas position that has been seen. Really, what we're understanding from Palestinian sources is that they are no longer demanding that there should be a full ceasefire from the outset of this three-phase deal to implement a ceasefire and have the hostages released that Palestinian armed groups are still holding in Gaza. And that seems to give some room for negotiations to advance.
Yolande Nell. India's main opposition leader, Rahul Gandhi, has urged the authorities to offer more financial help to those who lost their relatives in a deadly crush earlier this week. Mr. Gandhi made the comments after meeting grieving families in Uttar Pradesh. Our South Asia correspondent, Ambarasa Natarajan, reports from Delhi.
Rahul Gandhi said the families of the deceased had told him police security had been inadequate at the religious event on Tuesday. He also asked the Uttar Pradesh state government to pay compensation as early as possible, as most of the victims are from poor families. More than 120 people, most of them women, were trampled to death as a crowd surged to get the blessings of a spiritual leader, Suraj Pal Singh, known by his followers as Narayan Sakhar Hari, as he was leaving the venue.
Ambarasan Etarajan. Iranians are voting today in the runoff round of a presidential election which offers a choice between Saeed Jalili, a hardline conservative who's close to Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and Masoud Pezeshkian, a reformist who has backed pragmatic cooperation with the West. But with many people disillusioned with the process, turnout is expected to be low, as it was for the first round. The election was called after Iran's previous president, Ebrahim Raisi, was killed in a helicopter crash in May. Siavash Ardalan from BBC Persian told us more about the candidates.
It's very unpredictable at this stage, unlike UK elections. This is one of Iran's, the contradiction of Iran's political system, where you have so much unpredictability in an election in a country where it has some features of a democratic system, but also some features of a theocracy. It's hanging in the balance, and it really depends on whether more people turn out to vote this time around, those people who chose to boycott the election as an act of civil disobedience, who would rather now not have an hardline president and choose someone who is moderate, at least not to make things go from bad to worse, and the conservative camp, and people who voted for the center-right candidate who lost, who came in third, but won 13% of the vote, and that can be kingmaker. So if the same number of people who turned up last time, which was 40%, turn up again, and those conservatives within them who voted for the center-right candidate choose to vote for the moderate one rather than the hardline president, then we can see an upset in Iranian politics, and for the first time in 8 years, the succession and victory of a moderate president.
But let's say the moderate candidate was to get in. How much difference would that make? Because the reason there's such a low turnout is because people have voted for moderates in the past, only to see them unable to do very much because it's the hardline clerics that hold the real power in Iran.
Well, the biggest achievement of the moderates, especially President Hassan Rouhani and his administration, was to strike a nuclear deal with the U.S. and the other big powers. And then it was President Donald Trump from the U.S. who withdrew from that nuclear agreement. And that's why Iran's hardliners have become more powerful. Therefore, if this moderate president, as he promised, manages to strike another deal with the West, even with Donald Trump, say, being the next president, that can make a significant difference in the day-to-day life of people of Iran and the country's economy.
Siavash Ardalan. Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula is being battered by ferocious winds, and there are warnings of a dangerous storm surge with the arrival of Hurricane Beryl. The storm has left a trail of destruction across the Caribbean and the coast of Venezuela. At least 10 people are known to have died. One of the worst-hit islands is Carriacou in Grenada, a scene of devastation. Devin Andrews, Minister for Carriacou and Petite Martinique, spoke to Victoria Owakunda about the situation on the island.
The assessment that we have done thus far is indicating that over 98% of the island has been devastated. Be it our schools, be it our healthcare facilities, including our lone hospital on the island, be it our lone senior citizen home on the island, be it our airport, be it our police station, all government buildings, businesses, infrastructure, our utility companies were affected, our banks were affected, homes are completely destroyed, people are homeless, our gas station was compromised, thank God it's now up and running, communication was a massive issue because all our towers and services were down. It's like a war zone, it's like a bomb landed on the two islands, which I am responsible for. I cannot express the overwhelming feeling of grief, hurt, frustration, and a sense at times hopelessness that comes over me as a person responsible for leading the affairs of this beautiful island. I'm grateful for the support that we've been receiving thus far from the government of Grenada. But we need more. We need help. 98% of the island is completely gone.
Where are the people who've been made homeless now? Where are they living?
Some people are living in shelters. And mind you, some of those shelters that we had, hurricane shelters, was compromised. One of them was Dover Government School. The building crumbled. Thank God the people that went there to shelter the hurricane are all safe. They managed to run out during the storm and into the school's library. Most people are living downstairs, their home, with no roof or no upstairs. And of course, when rain falls, they get wet. In some instances, we're encouraging people to leave the island. And in some cases, they make a makeshift home for themselves at the broken down home.
Devin Andrews, Minister for Carriacou and Petite Martinique. An heiress to the Disney fortune has said she will withhold donations to the Democratic Party until President Joe Biden withdraws from the US presidential race. Abigail Disney, a long-standing Democratic donor, was speaking amid growing calls for Mr. Biden to drop out from the race for the White House after his dismal performance against Donald Trump in last week's first televised presidential debate. Peter Bowes told us more.
Abigail Disney is a filmmaker. She's a prominent Hollywood figure, philanthropist and longtime donor to the Democrats. And in a quite strongly worded statement that she issued, first of all, to CNBC, the business news television network here in the States, she said she would stop any contributions to the Democrats unless and until they replace Biden at the top of the ticket. He was, she said, a good man who'd served his country admirably, but the election stakes were far too high. She said the consequences of him losing were genuinely dire. And, of course, this comes in the wake, as you imply, of Mr. Biden saying that he has no intention of pulling out of the race. If he is rethinking, he's not showing that publicly. He did meet Democratic governors at the White House, and they came out with quite a supportive message, saying that they believe that he is the right person to challenge Donald Trump in the November election. I think the thing that's going to happen next that is going to be potentially crucial to this is a primetime television interview that Joe Biden is giving to the ABC television network. This will air local time on Friday night, and he will be, of course, asked questions that he will have to respond to off the cuff. There'll be no teleprompter, there'll be no script. This will be Joe Biden in a long interview having to think on his feet, be coherent, and talk in a way that impresses his voters to the point that they believe that he has what it takes to take on Donald Trump.
Peter Bowes, let's return now to our main story. the landslide victory for Labour in Britain's general election. Here's how the events unfolded.
And as Big Ben strikes 10, the exit poll is predicting a Labour landslide.
Penelope Mary Morden, commonly known as Penny Morden, the Conservative Party candidate, 13,715.
Democracy is never wrong. Tonight, the Conservative Party has taken a battering because it failed to honour the trust that people had placed in it.
Penny Mordaunt there, unsurprisingly perhaps, looking very upset, having fought very hard to keep her seat.
Farage Nigel Paul, Reform UK, 21,235.
There is a massive gap on the centre-right of British politics, and my job is to fill it.
Truss Liz, the Conservative Party candidate, 11,217.
The former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom has lost her seat, and this caps an appalling night for the Conservatives.
To the country, I would like to say first and foremost, I am sorry. I have given this job my all, but you have sent a clear signal that the government of the United Kingdom must change, and yours is the only judgment that matters. I have heard your anger, your disappointment, and I take responsibility for this loss. Following this result, I will step down as party leader, not immediately, but once the formal arrangements for selecting my successor are in place.
I feel like having competent adults in the room again is going to be a big help. Governing a country should be complicated, and it shouldn't be a thing that is done by people who are just jockeying for personal advantage in the way that we've maybe seen.
I don't think anything is going to change. It's been going on for years. Has anything been changed? No.
I think the future will be more better now in terms of job, in terms of safety.
I don't think a lot of change, to be honest. They've got the doctors to sort out, the railways to sort out. It's a big job.
The gates are open, causing a cheer to go up. The 58th Prime Minister of the United Kingdom arrives in Downing Street in that role for the first time.
Changing a country is not like flicking a switch. The world is now a more volatile place. This will take a while. But have no doubt that the work of change begins immediately. I invite you all to join this government of service in the mission of national renewal. Our work is urgent, and we begin it today. Thank you very much.
And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Vladimir Musechka. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.